gentlemen, it is Tuesday, February 20th. It's a great day. Ave Stephen Saylor. It's publication day for the final Gordianus, the finder, the elder, throne of Caesar.
Well, you say the final.
Right.
Never seen it. I intentionally call this the capstone.
Oh, the capstone.
Of the series, because that's a little ambiguous. Because we might still go excavate a little bit. There might be excavations or, you know, other structural work done on the series. But I do believe this kind of comes to a climax, and it does. At the end of the book, there's a certain thing that makes it kind of wrap around and start over again. So it's a loop.
There's a certain thing at the beginning, which I particularly liked, that loops back to Roman blood. So I thought that was a nice little hat tip to fans who've been with you the whole 27 years.
Yes, the opening is an echo of the very first book.
So just to clarify, Stephen Saylor spoke first, and his longtime editor, that was Keith Kayla from St. Martin's Press, is here doing the event tonight with us. And so he has comments too, because he's been, how many books have you done with Stephen?
I was actually there for all of them. I was the assistant on the first four, though by the time the fourth one came out, I was his editor. So let's just say that was from 95 on, so 23 years, call it.
Yeah, not bad. However many books. It's 14 novels and 2 books of short stories, I think. 16 volumes in all.
Let's see. There's 20 volumes that you've written. 2 were elsewhere, so 18. There were 2 volumes of short stories.
You're confusing me.
2 big novels, and then you're right.
Well, Roma and Empire outside of the Gordianus series.
Yes.
So there's been a lot of publishing going on between me and Keith. And the continuity I've had in my career has been really a wonderful thing. I've had the same agent. I didn't have an agent at the beginning. I finally got an agent. I've had the same agent, the same editorial between Michael and Keith for many years. And I've been coming to the Poison Pen here in Scottsdale many times. As I landed at the airport, I thought, how many times have I been to Phoenix over the years?
I think since Catalina's Riddle.
Probably. That was the third book.
Right. Yes. I'm looking at my copy of Roman Blood, brag, from 1991. So you've been doing this. Even I can do this math. Oh, come on.
27 years.
27 years.
Well, you know, I was really lucky. Roman Blood was published in 91 or 92.
91.
Right here.
And this was back in the boom Clinton years. And they were just touring every author. Every author who had written one thing was going to have to go to bookstores. And what I thought as an author, I was going to be a secluded person who never left the house, kind of a recluse. That's what the author was. Because when I grew up, there were only 3 authors who ever appeared in public. Gore Vidal, Norman Mailer, and Truman Capote. That was it. Everybody else, you didn't even know what they looked like. Heinlein, Tolkien.
Oh, you've forgotten Jacqueline Suzanne.
Well, that's the exception that proves the rule. But I came into publishing at a point when many authors were being toured at a very low level.
Uh-huh.
Sent out there, especially in a genre like the mystery genre. There were bookstores to go to, like the Poison Pen, venerable mystery specialty shops. So that is another gift, is the fact that I met readers early on, which is very important. You know, you don't think about that when you're sitting alone writing your first novel, that there are going to be people out there reacting. And to have been sent out in the world and to get feedback and response. Of course, that happens now for everybody because of Facebook and social media. But we actually had to go out there and fly around the country and go to bookstores.
And people wrote actual letters. We used to send out order forms and get checks back. We were so ready for the internet when it came along. I understand that you have an interesting origin story about how you got Roman Blood published. You didn't go a conventional route.
How I got it published? Well, I wrote the book just kind of as a leap of faith, inspired a lot by Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose. I thought I was writing a one-off literary novel. It just happened to be set in ancient Rome and Cicero and a murder trial. And then when I finished it, my good friend John Preston, who did an amazing amount of gay publishing, anthologies, things like that, there was a writer's conference in San Francisco called Outright. John Preston was there, and he loved to hobnob. He wasn't that great a writer, but he loved being a writer and knowing editors and making the rounds and connecting people. And he said, you know who might like that is Michael Denny at St. Martin's Press. Why don't you go drop that off at his hotel with a note for him and just say from John Preston Says. So I did that. The aspiring author, we didn't even have a copy. We printed out a dot matrix copy of the book. I said, I can do this tonight. I'll get the book printed out. The dot matrix copy was, you had to perforate the sheet, tear the perforated sheets. That's what I dropped off at the hotel, just as a leap of faith.
Did it look like a phone book?
It was big. It was a big thing. And I didn't even meet Michael Dennehy. He was there for panels. He just, he flew back with that book. And I thought, oh, my God, he's either going to hate me because this thing was like a telephone book, and I stuck this in his luggage. But he won't forget, maybe, because it'll be this thing he had to lug all the way back. Who is this writer that John Preston said I had to read? And it took 6 months of waiting for me. And all the writer's guides I'd ever read said, you must be patient. You must be patient. So I sent a couple of follow-up postcards in the day of postcards just saying, have you had a chance to read my novel, Rome of Life? And lo and behold, 6 months later, I got this letter saying, we have accepted your book for publication.
Wow.
And that is such an event in any writer's life.
Your first book?
Absolutely.
Especially.
That first hardback New York publishing book.
Right. So were you in on that decision?
I was, sort of. Of course, I was the assistant. I remember when he came back from the conference and brought this big box, thoroughly irritated, threw it in the corner, and by the second, or third postcard, he's like, ah! I think John Preston even called once or twice.
I think I probably prodded him, because as the unpublished aspiring author, you got to put yourself out there and ask for help.
He did finally start to read it, and I remember him coming in going, ugh, it's good. He was really unhappy that he, his peak was going to go, unrewarded, because he actually liked the book a lot.
Well, it really is an unconventional route to publishing, so persistence and good luck in knowing somebody worked out for you.
I don't think that has ever worked again in the 30 years I've been in publishing.
I had to be patient, but I did not have to go from house to house to house. I mean, some people have a book rejected 8 or 10 times, and I can't imagine how they can, do that.
Keep themselves
in good spirits.
So, Keith, was Roman Blood the natural title for this opus?
It was, though. I don't think I ever told you this. When you sort of buy a book and you present it to the publishing house, then it has to, it gets put on a list. So, like a fall list or whatever. And then the editor has to go and present that list when it's ready to be published, at an early stage, and present it to the sales, the marketing team. And those are called the launch meetings. And I remember going in with this book in the launch meeting, and Michael, who has a very unusual accent, presenting it, and it's sort of Rhode Island meets Chicago, and R's disappear entirely. And he's describing the book and presenting it, and the sales department put their hands up and was like, why don't you just call it Cicero's First Case? And I remember Michael going, no. They really were high on calling it Cicero's First Case.
I thought that story might be good. If he really drops his R's, maybe people thought he was saying woman blood.
It was.
That would be a
good
there's
been more than that. He did a book, off to the side on something else.
But I think I was lucky, because it is hard to find titles for books.
It was I don't think we've ever had a situation where we have retitled a book. I don't remember.
Of mine,
I think they've all been very good.
Yeah, I think the titles all work. In Roman Blood, it was a fortuitous choice, because it does stick in people's minds. It says what it is, Roman Blood.
Right.
And it also, because there's the crime has family connotations, blood,
exactly.
Not the bloodline.
What I do remember is, once it was bought, the contract done, and it was in production, Michael wrote, going, so, where's the next one?
Well, yes, and I thought I'd written the one-off.
So, well, that was going to be my next question. Why you had this long hiatus while you are sending postcards to New York and the boxes in the corner and all that good stuff? Were you contemplating a second book?
I don't believe I was working. I don't believe I had that much faith that this was going to, I would sell this book. So I wasn't thinking in terms of sequels. I was so naive as a reader, even though I had read long series of books, like by all the Sherlock Holmes books, I did not conceive of myself doing a series. I thought it was just going to be this one novel, and then perhaps I'd write something else. So it was Michael who, in a letter or phone call, he said, well, where's the second book? And I remember I was back home in Texas in my hometown in the winter, Christmas time, I think, walking on a country road, and it came to me, wow, I can do an open-ended series about the end of the Roman Republic. To me, the most fantastic period of human history. Everything is in there, from Cleopatra to the death of the Roman Republic, Julius Caesar's assassination, which we come to in the new book. So once again, just a real fortuitous, and it all worked out. There was a readership for the books.
And it really hooked you. Now, I did have a question because they've been very thoughtful, your publisher, Keith, about putting in the books in what I'm assuming is now chronological order according to Gordianus.
What do we have there? Yes, actually, it is. But instead of publication order, it's the order of his life.
Exactly, and that was what I was going to ask you, because the Gladiator dies twice is suddenly merged into this, and the House of the Vestals, and those are both short story collections, right?
The
Venus Throw? I get them confused.
No, the short stories are A Gladiator Dies Only Once.
Twice. You're right. I missed
it. A Gladiator Dies Only Once. And The House of the Vestals. Those are the two short stories. And all the short stories take place chronologically between Roman Blood and the second novel I wrote, Arms of Nemesis. And I did that just because if I was going to write a series of short stories, I didn't want to have to figure out, you know, this difficult chronology going back and forth. So they're very much, everybody stays the same in the short stories. The family doesn't change that much. And that particular period, I was just able to mine for just a lot of little story ideas. Because, for example, I wanted to have a death by bee sting. Because from the ancient poet Virgil, we have these wonderful, the eclogues, these poems about Roman beekeeping. So we know a lot about Roman beekeeping. And so there are various little avenues. The Roman diet from the cookbooks and so forth. Murders, poisons, all of that. So I wanted to do these little stories that weren't big enough for a novel. So those all fit into the short story sequences.
I like it.
There's also one of the stories that I particularly liked, which I think is in the second collection, but correct me, was the strawberry short story. There was this German academic at one point wrote you and said,
Cherries. Yes, strawberries. Rick, you're the botanist. Are strawberries New World or Old World? See, I have to be very careful about my food.
Yeah, you do.
Because the Roman diet is a particular diet, and it's what they had at the time in the Mediterranean that's changed over time. So in one of the stories, I had cherry. Oh, no, in Roman Blood, I think. In Roman Blood.
Yes.
In Roman Blood, Gordianus is musing about his beloved concubine, Bethesda, and I believe he says her lips like cherries. And a German reader, a very astute guy, Stefan Kram, who kept websites about all Roman fiction of all sorts in every language, is probably still up. But he wrote me and said, you know, I think we were having a new edition done. And I said, do your worst, Stefan Kram. What did I get wrong? What are the things I need to fix in these books historically? And he said, you have cherries in Roman Blood. So I had to, so they didn't have those yet because cherries came from the Black Sea region and I was 10 years too early. The general Lucullus went over there, conquered Asia Minor and brought back cherries, which were a sensation, this new food. He brought back the trees and they planted them. Now they had cherries in the diet. So I changed it to pomegranates in Roman Blood. All the editions after that, her lips are like pomegranates, which I know they had because of Anne Baxter as Nefer in the Ten Commandments. Oh, Moses, are her lips like pomegranates? I digress, all that ancient world background. So finally, in a short story, I wanted to get back to those cherries, and I wrote a story called The Cherries of Lucullus, because Lucullus was the man who brought the cherries back. And so we have cherries, we have Lucullus. Lucullus apparently had dementia. This is something we know about because of just the writing we know. So it's about that happening, cherries. So yes, in a short story, I was able to loop it around. And yes, the cherries have arrived in Rome. It's a big deal. Everybody has cherries now.
Well, I think it's helpful that you've put them in chronological order because since Stephen and I have been doing this together, like you, for forever, I knew the books did not come out in the order they are currently listed.
Well, almost entirely. I wrote them all in sequence until the last three before Throne of Caesar, and those were prequels. which will go back to Gordianus' youth.
Right, but so I wasn't including those, but they are in fact at the top of the list. Now they're at the top. Wonders.
So people ask me who don't know the series, say, what should I start with? And I'm not quite sure, because if you want to start with the first one the author wrote, that's Roman Blood. But if you want to start with Gordianus' earliest adventures, that would be the Seven Wonders, when he's a young man and goes to see the Seven Wonders
of
the world.
That's a really interesting question. Keith, what would you recommend?
I say, to quote another writer, always start with the new hardcover.
Exactly.
Buy it, because the books always read better in hardcover.
That is correct.
And you're the editor, not the bookseller in this conversation.
that also is answer, yes.
I would say, if one wants to start, I would start with Roman Blood.
But
I feel like it's a good introduction to the character.
But
and the milieu.
If the reader were to begin with the new book just out in hardback, Throne of Caesar, that would kind of start them off at the very end, and then there's a da capo where he sends you back to the beginning. And I know readers who've actually done what I have done as a writer. You don't research these things in order. You don't read your Roman history in order. You learn it from just all kinds of places, and you have to create that in your head. So I do know readers who have read them out of order, for whom that's a perfectly adequate experience. And I've done this with reading other mystery writers out of order. It's like you read a book and you see, this is a certain relationship between these two people. And they're talking about some kind of backstory. I wonder what that is, the death of a child or something. And then when you go back and read that book, there's the moment of research and revelation. That explains why that happened in the later book. So
what I would say is, unlike a lot of series, you can read actually any book and enjoy them as a single thing. All the relationships are clear in that book.
And it doesn't spoil any of the plots.
Exactly.
To give you an example, going back to ancient Egypt only, Victoria, if you were to read Elizabeth Peters' Amelia Peabody series, you would never be able to go back to Crocodile in the Sandbank, the first one, after any other book, because you'd have ruined the entire plot.
Oh, dear.
So that is not true
That has been a real challenge as a writer. Doing these historical mysteries, not only the historical research, I got to get everything right, the family history, create the mystery plot, all of that. Bring the reader up to speed with each book, because not everybody knows a lot of Roman history, so I have to have a certain amount of expository detail, but also not to spoil any previous plots. And that becomes a huge challenge.
I'm sure you can stick to the history, but you can't really.
Yeah, but how do you give things away?
So over 27 years, how do you keep track of the character's history?
Well, I think I can say I've gotten very little wrong historically. The cherries are an example, kind of thing. Anachronisms. What I have gotten wrong, the biggest mistake I ever made was one of the characters. It's Gordianus' son-in-law, Davos, who marries his daughter, Diana. And when Davos was first introduced, and I can't even remember now, I think he was a slave of Pompey, who Pompey loaned him to Gordianus for this investigation. He got somebody pregnant, as these things happen, and then he was taken into the family. But in the very book right after that, I had gone off and written a novel called A Twist at the End about Texas, a long historical novel.
Right.
And I forgot my own family history. And the origin of Davos, I got something wrong in the very next book. And to this day, it remains in many of the foreign language editions, because you just can't fix these things. It's like the boy with his finger that you can't fix all these things, or the Sorcerer's Apprentice, I should say. We have fixed it in the English language books, because then in the paperbacks, you can go back and make seamless fall. So the biggest mistake I've ever made was my own family history, not anything in the Roman world.
In the Roman realm.
Yeah.
So why has it taken you this very long time to write The Throne of Caesar? There's been a big gap between The Judgment of Caesar and The Throne of Caesar.
Well, that I went off and did the prequels.
Okay.
Essentially. We had come to the point in the series when I could no longer put off the assassination of Caesar. I mean, we have three novels now with Caesar in the title, Judgment of Caesar, Triumph of Caesar, Throne of Caesar. So I finally had to somehow make a novel that has as at its core and its background the assassination of Caesar, the Ides of March, the most famous murder in history. And you write a murder mystery about that. This that Shakespeare guy. He spoiled it, right?
We don't want you to give away what you actually did, but I think what you did was very clever, and I gather that it took you a long time to figure out.
Yes, a moment, you know,
your way to this.
I do explain in the author's note, and don't read the author's note before the novel. At the head of the author's note, it says, this note contains elements of the plot. Don't read it unless you want to. Because in the author's note, I get to speak freely about how I did get the way to make this into a mystery novel. And I think a specific scholar, who all he had to say was like one word to me, one name. And then it's like, oh, yeah.
I could do that.
That's it. That's going to be it. But then I had to do a lot of actually very original research about something, probably as deep as I've ever dove into doing kind of original scholarship, because it's a corner that has not been illuminated. I can't say what this is.
No.
What it is. But I promise you it's going to be something that's rather eye-opening even for Roman scholars who don't... this is kind of a little... In fact, I was just saying to a guy who was the dean of Roman classics for many years at Berkeley, sort of explaining, and I was explaining an element of the plot, and his eyes got really wide, like, what?
Uh-huh.
That's what that person was famous for? So anyway, it gets into some very esoteric knowledge.
So when you finally came up with this idea, you loved it, and really...
Absolutely, I thought, that's it, now I got my traction. I'm ready to go. But I have to say, actually writing a novel in which the assassination of Caesar takes place, I really love doing the thing where there are just a few things in Roman history where you can get down to a day-by-day, minute-by-minute chronology of certain things. One of them is the murder of Clodius on the Appian Way. Because that's in my book, A Murder on the Appian Way. Because of we have a commentary by this guy about Cicero's murder oration. And that gives us this amazing chronology of the actual minute by minute, virtually, of the murder and its aftermath. We have the same thing with the assassination of Caesar. Because of the multiple sources, and the book, the go-to book, nonfiction, is called The Death of Caesar by Barry Strauss. A very prominent historian. You've seen him on TV. He does a lot of documentaries. But he's also a very scrupulous historian. So his was my go-to book about getting everything in a row. I don't really know that there's ever been a fictional treatment of the assassination of Caesar that is quite as detailed and sort of just gets you from place to place to place. Because we do know sort of the final days and the final hours of Julius Caesar and the very hours that follow that. So I hope I made a very kind of gripping blow by blow. And there, you wonder about the suspense. I think actually there's a kind of suspense when you know what's going to happen because you're waiting for the shoe to drop, right? And so that's the first murder in the book, but not the last murder.
And I think you should stamp right there.
I'll stamp right there.
So I have one final question for Keith. When you are editing Stephen's book, you're not actually doing the Roman history part, right?
No. I mean, there, I think, at most, I might occasionally, over the course of time, have asked, you know, clarify this a little more, explain this a little more, or... might even be like, this goes on too long. Those might be the only sort of directions I would give. And even that's not all that common.
Well, one comment that you made that really sticks in my head, outside of the Gordianus series, I've done these family sagas beginning with a novel called Roma,
right.
The very foundation of Rome, through a family saga up to the time of Caesar. And then a second novel followed that called Empire, which is about all those crazy empires between Augustus and Trajan and Hadrian. And so it's got Nero in there and Domitian. And there's one point where we have the opening of the Roman Colosseum, which is a huge event. And we have Martial's poems, which tell us the kind of show that went on there. And Keith had a note in the margin where he's saying, I believe the reader may have come to, was it cruelty overload, horror overload? Because there were just so many atrocities I don't know if the burning of the Christians is before or after the opening of the Colosseum, but they're just all these hair-raising events. And I thought, okay, I guess we need to tone it down just a little bit here.
Possibly verisimilitude was not your friend right in that.
Although you don't know with the modern reader where that threshold is. Anybody that watches Game of Thrones, body parts being cut off and sent to the parents. I mean, what is the threshold now for what's shocking and unacceptable?
That's a really tough question to answer in February of 2018 on so many levels. I don't even want to go there. I guess you have to stay true to the spirit in which you have written the books and see how it goes. What's your next project? Are you going to work on the, you've done the two big books, so you've got one to go. Mm-hmm. Is that going to be a trilogy?
Yes. I mean, having done the capstone, I like to call it,
right,
of the Roma Sub Rosa series with the Throne of Caesar, on contract, my next book is a third book to follow Roma and Empire. And that would take us in the family saga from the time of Marcus Aurelius, the great philosopher emperor, and his playboy, no good son Commodus, famous from the movie Gladiator. Although my Commodus will be very different from that Commodus. Through a very rocky period of Roman history, up to the time of Constantine the Great, who makes the empire Christian.
Right.
So from Marcus Aurelius to Constantine. Yeah. And it's proven to be, I mean, it's there's fantastic material all through there, but the sources are very difficult. And it's been a book with a long gestation. So that's going to be the next one. That's the next.
And we don't need to know what you're going to do next. We should leave us all in suspense. Well, Stephen, thank you very much for talking to me, and you too, Keith. And I guess we should wind this up and go out and do a program for your fans who are assembled.
Thank you for having me here, Barbara.
It's always a pleasure. I'm really delighted. And I will say that I did a little tiny bit of research in order to make this fun, along with the grapes and cheese. I looked up ancient Roman wine, and I couldn't get Falernian, but they do recommend Frascati. However, the store was out of Frascati, so we're actually going to drink Orvieto.
Good so Chianti.
We'll see how it goes, right? Okay. All right, thank you.
Well, that was fun.